Adaptability is the key to happiness. If we can just remember this, then life will get a lot easier, and all we put our efforts into will be much more effective, I would suggest. As long as we're fixed in our ideas about what I need, what I have to have for my practice, how I should be, how they should be, the world should be, the more fixed that is, the more suffering. It's a direct relationship. Very simple equation. So as we reflect upon this ending of our life together, our little journey as this particular body of beings, as we separate out, enter into our different worlds. I'm expecting to get on a plane and fly to Thailand tonight. This is the attitude that's going to serve us, help us most completely, to be adaptable. When I went to spend a year in India on pilgrimage, I decided to practice based on two principles. One, not to find fault with anyone or anything. And two, to meditate on feeling. Whatever the feeling happens to be, here it is. This is the standing at the station being told that your train is 18 hours late feeling. This is standing at the station being told that your train has already gone 2 hours early feeling. It has been preponed, sir. Preponed? What is preponed? Preponed is the opposite of postponed, sir. Your train has gone. Okay. When's the next train? When we fixate on me and my practice, me and my Dharma group, me being a Dharma teacher, me being a Dharma student, me being a mother, a father, a child, the more we fixate, cling to roles, conventions, expectations, the more we create dukkha. It's a direct proportional relationship. More clinging equals more dukkha. Less clinging equals less dukkha. If we change the paradigm, we change the model from me and my practice, me and my problems, to the Buddha mind, the wisdom mind, seeing the way things are, Buddha seeing the Dhamma. Then the world changes. We still have debts to pay, lists of things to do. People who look at us as mom and dad, son and daughter, teacher, monk, friend, enemy. We still receive the projections of the world, but they're held in a very different way. It's the wisdom mind receiving the way things are. And in that wisdom, there's infinite spaciousness, unconfined in capacity, cognizant in nature. As we experience this flow of time, these last few hours together, and as our world changes before us, getting into our cars, heading off down different roads, receiving the perceptions of Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Haifa, wherever it might be, the airport, Thailand. If we bear this in mind, not me and my problems, me and my projects, me and my practice, but here is the Buddha mind, the awake wisdom mind, seeing the way things are. Then we're always able to adapt, to enjoy the surprised feeling of blessing when things go well, and to be at ease, patient with the surprising difficulties, curses, problems. This is essentially what it means to be practicing based on right view rather than self view. As long as it's me trying to do something to get somewhere off in the future, we've created huge obstacles. If you start off with avijja, with ignorance, the result has to be dukkha, dissatisfaction. If we start off with vijja, awareness, wisdom, the result is nibbana, peacefulness, attunement. Now we are all different. We're women, we're men, Israeli, English, American, scientific types, artistic types, quiet types, extrovert types, all sorts, note-taking types, listening types, all sorts. So different expressions, different words are going to work for us. The Advaita Vedanta expression is, I am that. Tat ahang asmi. Or, you are that. Tat tvang asi. The Pali expression is, I am not that. Ne tang mama, ne so hamasmi, na me so me ata. That is not mine. That is not me. That is not what I am. Maybe I am that works for you. Maybe I am not that works for you. Same, same. We need to experiment, explore, see what different expressions work for us. Or even as in the Torah, if it's not too dangerous ground to tread upon. I am that I am. Wasn't that the voice from the bush? I am that I am. We take off our shoes because it's holy ground. But that too, that's the expression that works for us. That's what we can use. The point of all these expressions, the words, the forms, even though some of them claim to be absolutely unique and true, one of the brilliant and insightful insights of the Buddha is that whatever the form is, whatever the expression is, that can't be the reality itself. Yena yena hi manyanti tatatang hoti anyatati. Whatever they conceive it to be, the fact is always other than that. No conception of truth can ever really fully describe it. It can point the way, but the realization has to be within you. Formless, wordless, infinite, awake. The words can point to that, but they can never completely describe that. So the Buddha used very simple language to talk about the transcendent reality. Just single words like, it's the island, the safe place, the beyond, the peaceful, the refuge, the pure. That's all. You don't get more poetry than that. 99% of the teaching is how to get to the island. In reflecting on ways that we can carry the same spirit of this time together, to carry it with us. We can use the kinds of recollection, intentions I was describing yesterday. Also, we can make a deliberate commitment to living according to the ethical standards of the precepts. One of the ways that we create this beautiful environment of peacefulness, reflection, we know that we're not stealing anything. We're not lying to anybody. We haven't deceived anyone or hurt anyone. Therefore, the mind is free from remorse. I don't have to regret having told any lies because I haven't told any. I don't have to worry about being found out about what I've stolen because I haven't stolen anything. One who lives by the ethical norms of sila doesn't have to think, may my heart be free from remorse. It is natural that one who lives respectfully, observing the sila, it's natural that their heart is free of remorse. One who is free of remorse, there's no need for them to think, may my body be relaxed, may I be free from anxiety. And so on. Basis of self-respect, of contentment, concentration, insight. So much of it is naturally based on living in a respectful, honest, kindly way. Using our speech to unite rather than divide. Using our capacity to act, to exercise kindness, compassion, rather than selfishness. To respect the lives of other beings. To consider, how could my life possibly be more important than yours? Even if you happen to be a spider or green fly, mosquito, why is my comfort more important than your life? How could that be? During this time, hopefully we've had the opportunity, taken the time to explore the relationship between mindfulness and wisdom and our conduct. When we're no longer living amongst a bunch of quiet, restrained people, we're back in the rowdy universe, where at least three or four people are speaking at once, it becomes more of a challenge. But we can do it. Not that we have to keep noble silence, sit at the table with our lips sealed, but rather to consider, is this worth saying? Is it true? Is it useful? Do I need to make some kind of clever remark that insults somebody else, that makes fun of another? Is that beautiful? Is it noble? Helpful? If we take the five precepts as a framework for our conduct, to undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature, to undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given, undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct, meaning engaging sexually with those who are not interested in us, who have arrangements with somebody else, or we have arrangements with somebody else, but then being deceived by our conduct, or taking advantage of another. To undertake the precept to refrain from lying, to not use false speech, and to undertake the precept to refrain from in consuming intoxicants that cloud the mind, alcohol, drugs, that create heedlessness, unmindfulness. We have these words spelled out just like you have in the biblical texts. Do this, don't do that. But hopefully during this time, you will have had the chance to develop the realization that it's not just control from outside that tells us do and don't, but rather the inclination of your own pure heart to listen to that in our heart which respects the lives of all others, respects the feeling of ownership that others have for their property, that loves honesty, delights in concord, respects the minds and bodies of others, the relationships and commitments that exist within us and between us. To respect that in us which loves mindfulness, loves clear awareness, recoils from confusion, pulls away from states of mind that are distorted, confused. Not because of a moralistic reaction, but because of the discomfort, pain we cause to ourselves if we act when we can't see clearly, can't think clearly. To not be refraining from intoxicants because the Ajahn told you that you shouldn't do that. The commandment says, thou shalt not. But rather, why would I want to do that to myself? If the brain surgeon about to do an operation on my child says, is it okay if I have a couple of brandies before I start? You know, just to steady the hand. How would we feel? If I was you, I'd look for another surgeon. I like to think of the precepts as a portable retreat. How we carry the spirit with us, regardless of what the world around us is doing. Irrespective of whether others are cursing us or mistreating us, we don't have to curse back. Abhayadana, the offering of fearlessness, has a powerful effect. Also, Ajahn Jha used to emphasize in the monastery that we have far more than five precepts. If you add them all up, it comes to about 10,000, give or take. He would always point out it's not just a matter of keeping the rules for the sake of keeping the rules, but when we respect the discipline, it's a direct support for mindfulness. The fact you've taken a precept against harming insects or damaging plants means that you're mindful when you're sweeping the ants off your porch. You're careful not to harm them. The precept supports mindfulness, and mindfulness supports the precepts. And it has an effect. Our care, our concern, touches the lives of others. A group of soldiers were visiting Amravati about a month ago from the Royal Engineers Bomb Disposal Unit. So mindfulness and clear awareness is important to them. Though we were sitting outside in the courtyard, up the pillars of the courtyard, the cloister at Amravati, there's wisteria plants growing with long, thin fronds that the leaves grow on. As I was sitting talking to them, one of these leafy fronds blew in the wind and was waving around in front of my face. So I took it and bent it back and tucked it neatly behind some other leaves to keep it out of the way. A moment later, one of the soldiers said, can I ask you, you moved that frond of the plant out from in front of your face and you tucked it behind the other leaves. Is that because of your rules? And I said, yes. As a monk, I'm not even allowed to break the leaf of a living plant. So this brought us onto the whole discussion of Sila and being in the military. Interesting discussion. And he said, because, you know, 99 out of 100 people would have just broken that off. Keep it out of the way. So as the conversation continued, the wind was still blowing and it unfurled that same little frond, that little branch of leaves. So it was wagging in front of my face again. And then the soldier took it, and the soldier carefully tucked it away. And being an engineer, he did a much better job of it than I did. He tucked it effectively out of the way and didn't harm any of the leaves and didn't break the stalk. So that made the whole day with the army really worthwhile. Yeah. There was a transmission of a respect. Okay, you're a soldier, but you can still respect the life even of a little frond of a wisteria plant. Something in there respects that, understands that. That was the big moment of the whole day, I think. That was the main teaching. When we take precepts against lying, when you're in the middle of a conversation and you find you're starting to bend the truth for the sake of a good story, something in the mind that says, well, it didn't quite happen that way. You know, I think you're exaggerating. We can listen to that. We can stop ourselves even in mid-sentence and say, actually, it wasn't really quite that way. But I was just dressing it up for the sake of making a good story. We don't have to commit ourselves to the lie. That very precept helps us to be more mindful, to pay attention, to help ourselves live more respectfully, more harmlessly, more beautifully, more effectively. And this is a theme Ajahn Chah would stress over and over again. The rules in themselves are just arbitrary. They're so many of them. They're not important. You could do it this way, do it that way. Most of the tiny little monk rules are not about saving lives or causing great harm. Tiny little details of our lives. So, but if you ignore them, you end up just following your impulses. Blindly following your likes and dislikes, habits and preferences. So to respect them then helps you to see all those habits, the impulses, all the likes and dislikes. And when they're seen, then we can free the heart from its addiction to them. If we don't see them, then that freeing is impossible. So over and over again, he would stress that the precepts are not useful just in terms of controlling behavior, but they're most useful in helping us to be awake, to keep track of our emotional impulses, preferences. To know them, see them, feel them. And to keep being alert to that bridge that we cross between liking and wanting, or disliking and hating. The precepts are like flags that tell us there's a bridge approaching. You're coming close to the bridge. Slow down. That's what the precepts are for. Do you want to cross? Are you sure? So it supports a mindfulness that helps us to simply stay with the feeling. If we're sexually attracted towards some person, we can recognize, well, I like her or him. Yes, that's an attractive person, but I'm married to someone else. So therefore, let's just let that be liking. And maybe she's got a girlfriend or a boyfriend. What does my partner think about it? Okay. And we can just leave it as liking. Simple, pure, easy, just on its own. Same with disliking. We see someone, they represent something that we dislike, or their actions are ugly. Okay, there's disliking. They say something. It's disliking. It's ugly. Off-putting. We don't have to hate it. We don't have to cross that bridge. We don't have to act. We don't have to follow that impulse. Again, it's disliking, but it's pure, simple, straightforward, easy. We hear a sound. We see an action. We don't have to react compulsively in relation to it. We don't have to attack that person or accuse them or blame them. Just like we don't have to chase after or flirt with someone that's attractive. We're not suppressing the feeling. We're not hating ourselves because of it. Just knowing. This is attraction. This is aversion. So the precepts are powerful, effective tools helping us to learn how to respond rather than react. This is their great usefulness, part of their great power. as we sit together. So it's an ideal opportunity during these last few hours together to look directly at the becoming tendency, bhava tanha. The mind creates a future, goes off to try and live in it. What I'm going to do when I leave here? Where I'm going to go? Who I've got to see? What I'm looking forward to? What I am dreading? Oh, how wonderful! Them again! Oh no, not them again. But they're not here. This is our imagination. The mind creates a future and then leans into it. This is bhava tanha, the desire to become. So this is the perfect opportunity to feel the presence of that, like leaning into the wind, feeling the pressure of, but, I've got plans to make, places to go, planes to catch, things to do. I gotta. But right now, that pressure is felt here, in this moment. And the mind that knows the pressure is not pressured. The mind that knows the becoming is not becoming. And when that feeling, that tension is known, then to some degree the heart is free of it. It's let go of. It's not believed in. Bhava nirodho nibbanam. The cessation of becoming is nibbana. In the moment that the heart is freed from that bhava, that becoming, here is the infinitely open present. Limitless. Anantang sabato pabang. Limitless, radiant in all directions, accessible from every side. Totally peaceful. This moment is the absolute peace. It has no limit. It's always here. So this time of ending, of plans for the future, intentions crowding in, it's a really good opportunity to consciously feel that pressure and to let go of it. To let the heart simply be open to this moment, even as the changes happen. To free the heart from that becoming urge. This is also called the floods, the ogha, O-G-H-A, the ogha. Maybe our English word urge comes from the same root. Outflowing of the heart towards that. And when that outflow is let go of, relinquished, notice how peaceful, how delightful this moment is. Enlightenment is also called kinasava, the stopping of the outflows. This is what it's pointing to. when the mind doesn't create past and future, race off trying to go and live there, when it attends to this moment, those outflows are ended. The mind is awake to its own reality, therefore clear, peaceful, free.